From the University of Texas at Austin, KUT Radio, this is In Black America.
Black educators perceive black girls in many ways, you know, as other educators perceive black girls. Okay. You know, there is some data, I've seen some bodies of data that talk about, you know, that black educators are more inclined to have higher expectations of black children. Mm-hmm. But in my research and in my work, you know, many of the black educators in some ways harbor some of the internalized oppressions that make it very difficult for black girls to be their whole selves. On the other, and that's particularly with respect to the dress codes and the ways in which black educators might be more inclined to emphasize the black respectability politics about how a black person needs to behave in order to not be in trouble later on, or that black people have a certain set of conditions that are unique to them, and so we try to have these conversations about maintaining safety, but sometimes those are reinforcing the structures of oppression rather than allowing our children to be free black children.
Dr. Monique W. Morris, education scholar, co-founder and president of the National Black Women's Justice Institute, and author of Push Out, The Criminalization of Black Girls in Schools, published by New Press. Push Out is a discussion about the experiences of African-American girls across the country whose intricate lives are misunderstood, highly judged by teachers, administrators, and the justice system, and degraded by the very institutions charged with helping them flourish. Morris shows how, despite obstacles, stigma, stereotypes, and despair, African-American girls still find ways to breathe remarkable dignity into their lives in classrooms, juvenile facilities, and beyond. Each year, millions of students face expulsion or suspension. According to research from the Department of Education Civil Rights Data Collection, 7 million of almost 50 million students faced in-school or out-of-school suspension in 2011-2012, the most recent year for which data is available. About 130,000 were expelled. I'm Johnny L. Hanson, Jr., and welcome to another edition of In Black America. On this week's program, Push Out, The Criminalization of Black Girls in Schools, with author Dr. Monique W. Morris, Part 2, In Black America.
When I talk about the curriculum that's been established and how it hasn't necessarily had black girls in mind, what I'm talking about are the ways in which we construct narratives in our learning, in our lesson plans, that don't completely factor in the identities of the students that are learning this now. And that everyone has a story associated with, you know, our presence and history in these lands. We can teach math through culturally competent material. And many scholars have been developing curriculum and have developed very rigorous curriculum to support learning in these spaces. But ultimately, we know that children respond best when they see themselves in the material they're learning.
In her latest research, Dr. Monique W. Moore shed light on the treatment of African-American girls in K-12 schools. Morris takes a closer look at the educational policies, practices, and conditions in our schools that marginalize black girls both academically and socially as early as pre-K. Morris frames this research around the stories of girls she spoke with across the country who experienced push-out, defined as a practice that fostered criminalization in school, and how this criminalization leads to imprisonment, to expose what she says are the untold stories of the conditions that remain a barrier to African-American girls' education and well-being. Recent studies from the U.S. Department of Education's Office of Civil Rights show that the current disciplinary measures end up barring these young students from schools at higher rates than those of any other female student group and most male groups, which puts them at a higher risk of entering the juvenile justice system. On today's program, we conclude our conversation with Dr. Morris.
Brown versus Board of Education was presented as a desegregation case, but ultimately it was about providing our children with quality education. And that's what we're after. And that's what we've always been after. And when I raise that, both in the book and in conversations with people about what it is that we're trying to achieve here, ultimately what we have to understand, not only is this about engaging in conversations about putting our kids in schools with children of other racial and ethnic groups, but it's really about understanding the historical legacy of the fight for quality education in this country and how there have been many structures that can either interfere with an access and equal access to quality education or support it. And so when I talk about Brown versus Board of Education, I talk about it in the context of Black women always being clear about, you know, the role that education can play in the liberation of our communities. And I also talk about it in the context of understanding how education is a critical protective factor against contact with the juvenile legal system, right? To understand that the fight for education was not just about desegregation. It was about quality education. It was about providing new opportunities. It was about centering the well-being of our children, which included Linda Brown in the Brown versus Board of Education, a girl, a little Black girl that we somehow forget when we talk about who was at the center of our fight for educational achievement and access to quality education. And so I think what we are doing when we revisit, you know, the 60 years after Brown versus Board of Education, you know, what we forget are the truths that underlie, you know, this fight for equity and the assumptions that we made as a Black community about the protective factor of education in our communities. Now, education still, as I said before, remains a critical protective factor against contact with the juvenile and criminal legal system for girls. And we have to understand that when we don't provide girls with a quality education or we don't provide them with access to consistent learning opportunities and we find new ways of pushing them out of school and getting them away from these protective factors, that we are actually contributing to their criminalization. And that's why I don't use the term school-to-prison pipeline. Mm-hmm. I use the term school-to-confinement pathways because we have to understand that there are multiple pathways facilitating the criminalization of our communities beyond just prison. We have to look at the multiple forms of confinement, the ways in which girls are under supervision of probation, the way in which girls are on ankle bracelets and monitored, surveillance in communities, confined to residential placement facilities. It doesn't always look like prison. And we have to open our paradigm. And I respect and appreciate the framework around school to prison or cradle to prison because ultimately that's what we want to avoid is the institutionalization, and it's urgent, and people can understand that. Criminalization is a little harder for people to wrap their brains around, but we feel it, and we feel it in the way in which people respond to certain behaviors, certain words, certain fashion trends. There's a consciousness that facilitates criminalization that I want to attack in this work because that, to me, is the broader issue. The incarceration is a symptom of the criminalization.
You talk about students being somewhat monolithic when they attend school. Everyone wants to be in lockstep. But you also address the uncertainties or not being aware of the culture in which some of these young ladies come from, and educators are not giving children a chance to be children.
Well, zero tolerance policies have made it very difficult beyond a very punitive response to the behaviors of children that are appropriate or associated with their own level of cognitive development.
Mm-hmm,
so
mm-hmm.
We've seen situations where, you know, some of the most egregious cases involving zero tolerance policies involve 6 and 7 year old girls who are arrested or handcuffed for having a tantrum in class. And, you know, many children have had tantrums. Any one of us who has been around a 6-year-old
exactly.
know that they can throw a mean tantrum and that we don't need police intervention to deal with it. And so
right.
I think, you know, it's really important for us to think through how this climate of punishment has rendered many educators dependent on a punitive response, even though there's emerging research, very compelling data out of Stanford now looking at empathic responses. So using empathy and connection to respond to student misbehavior as opposed to punishment and those type of formal interventions and how much that has reduced the suspension rates among girls, Black and Latina girls, but also the ways in which that has improved the student-teacher relationship.
Right.
It's not really rocket science. Michelle Foster talked about she wrote a book years ago called Black Teachers on Teaching, who really was able to uplift some of the conscious pieces of teaching that really had to do with the expectations we set for our children and the ways in which we were willing to build relationships with children to correct negative behavior, as opposed to rely on calling in law enforcement or sending a child out to the principal and allowing that child to lose respect for the teacher and their ability to manage conflict, but also failing to respond to the core issues that are at play here. And so that's what this is really a call for us to re-examine is, number one, to see girls in our conversation about school to confinement pathways and the structures of the structures that facilitate criminalization in schools, but also to respond to them in a way that is gender responsive and culturally competent so that we can address the root causes, the victimization, the other aspects of poverty and identity that are influencing adult decisions about how to respond to negative student behavior.
I talked about educators generally, but how do Black educators perceive Black girls?
I think Black educators perceive Black girls in many ways, you know, as other educators perceive Black girls. You know, there is some data. I've seen some bodies of data that talk about, you know, that Black educators are more inclined to have higher expectations of Black children.
Mm-hmm.
But in my research and in my work, you know, many of the Black educators in some ways harbor some of the internalized oppressions that make it very difficult for Black girls to be their whole selves. On the other, and that's particularly with respect to the dress codes and the ways in which Black educators might be more inclined to emphasize the Black respectability politics about how a Black person needs to behave in order to not be in trouble later on, or that Black people have a certain set of conditions that are unique to them, and so we try to have these conversations about maintaining safety, but sometimes those are reinforcing the structures of oppression rather than allowing our children to be free Black children. And on the other side, you know, Black educators have been fierce defenders and total protectors of Black children in these spaces and have provided opportunities for Black children that some other educators may not be inclined to provide. They're able to establish the relationships, the powerful, positive student-teacher relationships that allow students to engage with school and reconnect with school in ways that can be both culturally competent, but also that can get these kids to understand, the girls particularly, to understand what it is that they need to accomplish and how education will make that connection for them. So, you know, there's certainly a case to be made for diversifying the profession and making sure that there are more Black teachers there who are working with Black children, but also that when we're working with Black girls in particular, we're aware, again, of the underlying factors associated with negative student behavior. One of the teachers that I interviewed for Push Out and talked about in the book is a Black teacher who talked about how in her work she has to teach more than the curriculum. And you can really do that. You can only do that if you care about the children, and you can only do that if you believe in the promise of all children and not in this idea that some children are not going to make it. The way in which we construct our teaching force and prepare them to engage has to address, you know, all of these issues. And I just want to underscore, you know, the importance of it not necessarily having to be a Black teacher who does this, but certainly there are some things to learn from Black teachers who routinely do it.
Speaking of curricula, you maintain that few curricula taught in elementary and secondary school were designed with Black girls in mind.
I bring that to the conversation because, in my mind, when we're talking about repairing relationships between girls who have experienced school pushout and schools, is a need for us to approach it in a way that allows for there to be responsive and debiased learning alongside healing-informed responses to problematic student behavior, healing-informed responses or classrooms and schools, and college and career pathways. But under the responsive and debiased learning is this idea that we've got to have culturally competent curriculum and a uniform way to provide training toward the reduction of implicit bias. And the absence of curriculum that speaks to the particular needs and histories of Black girls can be alienating and traumatic for many girls. There was a situation that I had observed in a classroom where students were reading material about slavery, and one of the girls rejected it because she felt that as the only Black student in the class, it was not safe for her to engage in that conversation. She didn't feel protected in that space. And so mm-hmm. when we talk to young people about the kinds of education that they need, not to present themselves as inferior or to locate their origins in this country through the lens of a very deeply oppressive system of slavery, right, but to talk about the full story, to understand it in its proper global context, meaning we call this the transatlantic slave trade or the African slave trade when, you know, as many scholars before me have said, we should be calling it the European slave trade because African people were not the ones committing these heinous acts of violence against African people by and large, but there's a framing and a way in which we have to teach this material such that our young people understand who they are and what they are capable of. And without that kind of liberative pedagogy or that kind of structured systems of conversation and ways to interrogate this work, then in many ways it can be oppressive even more so. And so when I talk about the curriculum that's been established and how it hasn't necessarily had Black girls in mind, what I'm talking about are the ways in which we construct narratives in our learning, in our lesson plans that don't completely factor in the identities of the students that are learning this now. And that everyone has a story associated with, our presence and history in these lands. We can teach math through culturally competent material, and many scholars have been developing curriculum and have developed very rigorous curriculum to support learning in these spaces. But ultimately, we know that children respond best when they see themselves in the material they're learning. So it really doesn't matter what subject you're teaching. There's a way to do it in a way that is inclusive.
Looking at your own educational experience, how did you navigate this minefield?
You know, it took a while. I was always clear that education was an important lesson for me. My family is from Texas, mm-hmm. and my grandma was always very clear about the fact that I needed to learn my lesson.
Exactly.
And I appreciate her for that. And my mother established, I'm the eldest of five to a single mother. And so for me, reading was liberative. Learning how to perform well in school was going to be my pathway to freedom. I was very clear about that. And so I think grounding myself in that practice and understanding who I was and who I wanted to be was an important part of my ability to navigate these landmines. When individuals started to try to police me or to police my laughter or police my volume or challenge my intellect, I was very clear about who I was and developed skills that provided me an opportunity to speak. I write books now. That's my way of speaking out, right? And so, you know, what it is we've really got to engage with ourselves and our young people about developing the skills they need. You can still challenge the structures of oppression. You know, we started this discussion about Muhammad Ali. He found his voice, right, to do
right.
it the way he needed to do it. And I think there's a lesson in that for all of us about how we uplift and maintain the authenticity of our voice and to be strong and fearless in that space and grounded in the successes and challenges of our ancestors as we continue to press this country to be a more inclusive space and our structures to respond to the specific needs of Black people. And so, you know, for me, that's really what this has always been about, and I'll continue to find new ways of telling stories that are healing and that can help repair relationships, because I think that's really a part of this as well.
I know, that's right. Having said that, what do you think the best predictors for girls' success in school?
You know, it's important to have a couple of things in place for girls in school, and I talk about this quite a bit. Number one, we have to address the victimization that's happening in the lives of Black women and girls. We have to have more open conversations about sexual assault. We have to have more open conversations about sexualization of girls, and we have to address the ways in which girls are not necessarily constructed or not necessarily learning in safe spaces. There are three questions that I think should be central to all of the policy work that's happening and in the development of new programming and responses to Black girls. And the first one is, what are the assumptions that are being made about the conditions of Black girls? You know, we've been operating as if we know what the deal is, and so we've got to address those assumptions. Number two, how, you know, might Black girls be impacted uniquely by school and other disciplinary policies, right? So what's happening in the world of discipline that's facilitating school pushout as it pertains to Black girls? Continue to ask these questions and ask them on a local level. How are organizations, policies, and systems creating an environment, right, that's conducive to the healthy well-being of Black girls? How are we all playing a role in the development of this ecosystem, right, and in this space for girls? our expectations for girls cannot be lowered, our standards cannot be lowered for girls, and we have to really examine whether we're doing that either implicitly or unconsciously, or if we have just sort of written off that girls are not good at blank, or these girls in particular are not good at blank, and so we don't provide the opportunities for them to engage. We have to engage in practices that provide more opportunities for healing and leadership among Black girls in schools. And we have to have talks within our own communities and within our schools about really a candid discussion about sexism and patriarchy and the role in which it doesn't serve our communities well at all. And these are difficult conversations to have, but these are the kinds of things that if we truly are moving toward freedom and working toward being free people, we have to engage. And we've got to address the consciousness that has been debilitating in many ways, as well as having real honest conversations with our girls today in our lives, the ones that live down the hall, you know, from us in many, right, in many spaces, about what they need to feel safe in our communities, and then respond to that. This question about safety and education, many of the girls that I had talked to, that was the first time anyone had ever asked them. And so, you know, really, you know, that we are not engaging in conversations with our young people about what they need to feel safe beyond how it's come to be represented, you know, on television is deeply problematic. And so, you know, I think I encourage everyone to begin to have these kinds of conversations with girls so that we can begin the healing process.
Well, you do mention that in the book, you know, have a talk with girls, not just boys.
I do. I do. And I mean it. I'm the mother of two girls, and I started having the talk, quote unquote, very early on. And that talk was absolutely about safety in public spaces, but it was also about safety in private spaces.
Right.
And it was also about understanding internalized oppression. And it was also about understanding systems that may not necessarily work in my favor. And so how I develop skill sets to manage those conditions are all a part of remaining safe in these spaces. So we've got to have honest conversations about skills development, about what school can do, what school can't do, right?
Mm-hmm.
And what other services and programs and individuals need to be in their lives in order for them to be their most competitive and best selves.
A couple of more questions, Dr. Morris. How is it important, and we look into the future, that we need to, and we being the educational system and schools in particular, of pushing back on these law enforcement officers and security guards taking over the discipline of our children in school?
Yeah, I have a project now. NBWJI has a project with the Georgetown Law Center on Poverty and Inequality that's looking at the relationship between school resource officers and girls of color.
Mm-hmm.
And we're spending some time, particularly in the South, having conversations with girls and with law enforcement. And I think it's important, you know, to have the conversations about what it is that we have assumed about the well-being of our children that we feel we need so much of a police presence in schools,
right.
But also really what we've got to do is have other conversations with our children about the conditions that they need to feel safe in school. So in many ways, my answer to that is related to my answer to the other questions you have. I am not one that believes that safety can be implemented. We have to co-construct safety. So that means you have to have multiple people in the process of understanding and contributing to the conversation about what it means to be safe in schools. That does not mean that because you have had incidents that you automatically institute security or you automatically institute law enforcement or you automatically have police or you automatically have security cameras and metal detectors. What we've got to do is address the consciousness piece here and understand that perhaps schools may feel that that's what they need, but we shouldn't assume that that's what they need.
Right.
And so when we're talking about allocation of resources and funding, we also need to respond to the root causes, the root issues here when children are having conflict, and engage a full continuum of other strategies that have been working in schools across the country to address these issues without the involvement of law enforcement. So there are many, you know, restorative approaches. There are many circle convenings and modalities that have been used to respond to negative student behavior. There are lots of discussions again about, you know, engaging with empathy as opposed to with discipline.
Mm-hmm.
You know, educators used to handle these issues all the time, and
Quite well.
Some things may be beyond what they feel they can manage. But for the most part, educators are in this because they love children.
Exactly.
And they believe in the promise of education and know how to intervene and connect. And those are the skills that we need to really uplift in our conversations about corrective behavior, not punishment and citations and contact with the juvenile and criminal legal system, especially because I'm very clear that we don't see these instruments of surveillance in all schools.
Mm-hmm.
We see them in high poverty schools that are disproportionately composed of children of color, Black and Latino kids. So, you know, what we're talking about is, again, shifting the consciousness on who we think needs to have police and surveillance and who we believe can have their behavior corrected in other ways.
Final question, Dr. Morris. I found it interesting you have two appendix, and particularly Girls, We Got You. The Q&A,
yeah,
I found most interesting.
Good. I'm glad you did. I did a Q&A in concert. You know, a lot of people ask me questions as I've been doing this work around the country and talking about the conditions of girls. And so what I did was collect the most common questions I get from girls directly, from parents, and also from educators about how to support the well-being and educational achievement of Black girls and to prevent school pushout. And so the responses to this are certainly my thinking, but it's my thinking in concert with a host of other women who have been working with Black girls, in particular in schools, and who are working with girls who have experienced school pushout. And so I hope that readers get from the appendix the collective wisdom and experience that we have been using and engaging in this conversation. And the questions span from things like, you know, why should I care about school among the girls, or, you know, what do I do if I feel my teacher is picking on me from the girls, to, you know, how do I get along better with my mom? And then on the parent side, you know, what can we do at home to support my daughter in school, or how do I build trust to get my daughter to talk to me about what's bothering her? So some of it is really about the relationship building that needs to be in place to really support the well-being of our girls. And then among the educators, you know, it's about alternatives, right? How can I keep my classroom safe without security, or how can I get parents involved in keeping their daughters from fighting? So those kinds of real questions that we have been getting, I have been getting for quite some time now, and I'm sure that list will grow as I continue to talk about push out on the road and have a chance to, you know, respond to these issues. One of the things that we're seeking to do, NBWJI, this summer is to build out a web presence to have greater resources for communities and parents and educators who are working on this subject. So I like to see push out the book as the beginning of a conversation that I hope will lead to a much more robust engagement and in the supports of our girls.
Any final comments, Dr. Morris?
Just that I think it's time for us to really center in our conversation the extent to which we're going to practice the idea that Black girls are sacred and loved. When we lead with love, that's when we see change, not when we lead with discipline.
Dr. Monique W. Morris, author of Push Out, The Criminalization of Black Girls in Schools, published by New Press. If you have questions, comments, or suggestions as to your future In Black America programs, email us at jhanson@kut.org. Also, let us know what radio station you heard us over. Remember to like us on Facebook and to follow us on Twitter. The views and opinions expressed on this program are not necessarily those of this station or of the University of Texas at Austin. You can hear previous programs online at kut.org. Until we have the opportunity again for technical producer David Alvarez, I'm Johnny O. Hansen, Jr. Thank you for joining us today. Please join us again next week.
CD copies of this program are available and may be purchased by writing In Black America CDs, KUT Radio, 300 West Dean Keaton Boulevard, Austin, Texas, 78712. That's In Black America CDs, KUT Radio, 300 West Dean Keaton Boulevard, Austin, Texas, 78712. This has been a production of KUT Radio.